welcome to Dynasty As They Want to Be, a podcast where we drill into every episode of the iconic 1980s television series, Dynasty. I'm your host, Derek J. Lang, and with me is my co-host, Kyler K. Jafari.
Hello to all you party people.
Are you doing Elizabeth Taylor at the 1998 Golden Globes?
Well, I heard the Golden Globes were canceled, so I thought I'd go back in time to one of my own favorite Golden Globe moments.
Wonder Boys.
Aaron Brockovich.
Gladiator.
Sunshine.
If you don't know what the hell we're talking about, was it the 98 Golden Globes? Did I guess that right?
I believe it was 97, 98. Yeah. Gosh, I don't know.
Late 90s, Elizabeth Taylor presented Best Picture, and I don't know if it was pills or booze or liquor.
Back surgery, all of the above.
Yeah, some sort of a cocktail. But yeah, she had trouble. And Dick Clark, RIP, well, RIP to both of them, really, had to come out and help her. And yeah.
I don't know. Every now and then I go down to an Elizabeth Taylor rabbit hole. And I found this years and years and years ago. And then, I don't know, it suddenly popped up in my mind again. And apparently Jinx Monsoon has made fun of this.
Yes, famous drag queen so Jinx Monsoon.
I'm glad I wasn't the only one that thought it was as, you know, I'm not going to use the word iconic, but, you know, she really played it off, though. You know, she gets the audience with her charm.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
she says, I'm new at this.
I usually win them. So shady.
And the winner is... Gladiator. All right. Anyway, so we're having one of my most very favorite drinks in the whole wide world. And I'm almost to the point wondering if we've possibly had these on the pod before, but I don't know.
Well, let me describe it to the listeners, because this is an audio medium. We're having a cocktail in a tall glass, a couple of ice cubes at the top, a beautiful fresh slice of, is this orange grapefruit?
It's mystery citrus plucked from our very own paradisal yard.
Oh yeah, we have a lot of citrus trees, and we're never sure if they're lemons, limes, clementines, tangerines, or
kumquats,
some sort of
loquats,
mutation of
grapefruit
them.
Lemon juice, who knows. This
And then
anything.
A bright red cherry on top. So what is it? I think
so
I know.
This is the French 75. This was in a old Mr. Boston cocktail book that I've had. One day I decided I would make it, and it's basically just like a Tom Collins, but instead of the soda water, you use, you know, sparkling wine or champagne if you dare. And I just think it's the perfect combination of citrus, gin, and sparkling wine. I mean, you've got the bubbles, you've got the brightness of the citrus. It's just a refreshing long drink. I think now, like, if you order it, it shows up in a frickin' champagne flute, which is always, I know, it's my old bromide about this drink. Somehow it turned into a bachelorette party.
Yeah, I see them on menus all the time. I mean, when I was going to places that had menus, but yeah, they're...
It's kind of a novelty drink for, you know, bitches who brunch.
It's one of those drinks that you know you can get fucked up if you drink, but it's not going to taste like...
That's part of the reason why I think it started being served in a champagne flute, because it cuts the drink in half. Because here's the thing, you're talking 2 ounces of gin, 3/4 to 1.5 ounces of lemon juice, depending on how tart you like it. And
right,
you're topping it up with at least 4 to 5 ounces of champagne, so that's almost... Two drinks in a glass.
So it's like a Long Island iced tea. There's no
soda
water.
Yeah, but I don't think
most
people know the French 75 like that. I think they know it as
the
champagne flute drink.
This is why the bachelorettes have pounced on it, because they can drink a bunch of them.
Anything that can come out in a champagne flute, like, that's bachelorette paradise. They love that shit.
And they can get lit. Anyway, I have a little email, quick note that I want to read that addresses something that we've been bringing up the past few episodes. I won't read the whole thing, just at the end here. So this is from Tony, friend of the show, frequent letter writer, not the gardener, Tony, but maybe that's why he calls himself Tony. Anyway.
Oh, I would love that if the gardener was secretly like the Tony that writes in.
Wait, our gardener?
Yeah.
Oh, no, we know our gardener's name. You think our gardener listens to the show? That's so embarrassing.
I would love that.
Anyway, he solves the mystery of why Kirby has the clock tower next to her in the opening credits. Do you know this?
I don't know. Is this because the mystery is revealed later in the storyline?
Yes.
Okay.
So, by the way, Kirby's clock tower or carriage house is part of Fioli, you know, which is where Dynasty is set. Or
is it Filoli or Fioli?
I never know. I always say it wrong.
It's Filoli House, I believe.
Filoli. And can be seen in the aerial shots. It represents Kirby in the opening credits as it's where Joseph lived when Kirby was growing up.
Wait, so Joseph was like ringing the clock bells like Quasimodo? Like,
I guess so. Okay. We find out that revelation in the Dynasty reunion, but you have to get through several seasons to figure that one out.
God, and after this season.
I hope that clears things up. Well, it does very much. Thank you, Tony. Although that does seem like some revisionist history on the part of the writers that they waited until the Dynasty reunion to reveal this about the clock tower.
Yeah, I mean, which came first, the storyline or the clock tower? It feels like they just had to write that in at some point because everybody was so confused. Why does she have this bizarre title card?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't really think that much about it, but I know you've brought it up. So Tony solved the mystery. Anyway, this is chock-a-block full of drama. This episode
was a real barn burner.
So I say we just take a break and then we get right into discussing this week's episode, The Threat.
Obviously, the way this episode ends pretty much sums up the entire point of this episode, for me at least. And this is sort of like Alexis's gambit. And she just watches all of her plots unravel and blow up in her face, which has happened before, but I don't think we've seen it so fantastically and delightfully perfect as we have in this episode.
Delightfully, she was almost strangled to death.
But it's so dramatic and wonderful. And you know, and she gets to play the poor besotten woman, you know, just as she does in the Lily Pond. And that's what Alexis does. Like, she gets herself into trouble and then she pretends like she's the damsel in distress. And it's like, come on, who buys that story? But okay, so you've got, obviously the biggest one is the backfire of her plot with Neil McVane. She gets him, you know, pretty much disbarred from Congress or whatever. And so of course he's coming for her. Then you have like, you know, like more of a minor plot, but it also does not work out in her favor in this episode, where she's trying to spin her relationship with Mark Jennings to Fallon, and Fallon's not buying any of it, of course. And, you know, so it just ends up just pissing her off more because, you know, again, Alexis is doubling down on her lies and Fallon's like, that's BS. And
yeah, she's already been down that road. Like, so she cuts ties pretty quickly.
Right. Then you have, like, of course, like, I think what is so obvious about this episode, it's sort of one of the only things people remember about this show if they've never even seen it before, is the throwdown with Crystal, which of course ends just terribly for arguably more for Alexis. I don't know. Does Crystal come out as the winner in that one? I think she does, right?
Oh, I would say it was a draw.
She looks, well, she has a classier exit, so I don't know, but maybe that's debatable.
She did lose an earring.
Where's Mrs. Carrington? I lost a pearl and diamond earring in the Lily Pond yesterday, and I want her to give you the authorization to have it drained immediately.
Sort of the thing that undercuts it all is the one thing that works out for Alexis in this episode is how she blackmails Joseph to drain the pond, but that's like sort of a Pyrrhic victory, right? Like, that's the only thing that worked for her in this whole episode. That's like small potatoes compared to how much she loses with everything else.
Yeah, so. And we don't even really see that come to fruition. So I don't even know if
not have even happened. Yeah, yeah. But she put Joseph in a spot where he had to like sort of acquiesce. So I consider that a win for her. But everything else that she's plotting in this episode just totally
blows up in her face.
She's just nothing but backfires.
Well, let's talk about this Lily Pond fight, because I didn't even realize that happened in the third season. Obviously, this is one of those moments that even people who have no idea what Dynasty is about know about Linda Evans and Joan Collins fighting in a Lily Pond.
Is this fight number two, or was there the one in the artist's studio,
right? So this is the second,
this is number two, okay.
Physical altercation.
I feel like I need like a lady with big hair and a two-piece string bikini and pumps, like with the poster board that says round two.
Well, we already have two women dripping, so I don't think we need another woman.
Gorgeous ladies of catfighting or whatever.
Well, Blake even says after the end of it that they look like female mud wrestlers, which I thought was very bitchy thing to
well,
say.
Well, I would hope that he wouldn't say that they look like male mud wrestlers, but I don't know what that even means.
It didn't seem like anything was necessarily building up to this point to me. Well, Alexis was inside, and as you kind of pointed out with your outline, the affair with Mark Jennings blew up in her face because Fallon kind of figured it out. And to Fallon's credit, she doesn't care if she was catfishing her, if it was real or whatever, because Mark basically said in so many words that he did have sex with her mother, and that was enough for Fallon to peace out and quit calling mother mother and calling her Alexis again in the library. And then, you know, after pouring herself a drink, Alexis looks out that magical window. No matter what you want to see,
there's nothing good out that window.
It's either the Garden of Eden, the Lily Pond of Doom.
Oh, but it's so deceptive.
Always something. But yeah, Crystal's just out there lounging, and she confronts her, and Crystal really is the one that throws the first punch. I mean, she throws the first shove, and then she does throw a punch that's terribly done. It's all because Alexis brings up the baby leaving, Steven's baby leaving that she wanted to adopt, and then she brings up the miscarriage, which is Alexis's fault, as we all know, because she shot that damn shotgun and made Alexis, or made Crystal fall off the horse. So
She calls her, like, one of the best lines of this episode, an empty-armed Madonna.
Mm-hmm.
Get out of here, Alexis. Get off your property. But it isn't really your property, is it, Mrs. Jennings? Get out! I know what's wrong with you. The empty-armed Madonna, mourning the baby that she couldn't have and the baby that she almost got to adopt. Gone now. That is it, isn't it? Oh, you miserable bitch!
Alexis, for all of her problems, she's always going to be more interesting to me because, you know, as we learned from Dante's Inferno, nobody cares what happens in paradise.
I don't know.
We like the devil. The devil's fun.
Yeah, well, you can hail Satan all you want. I'm really on Team Crystal right now because she is finally realizing that Blake is just using her, and it's not a 50-50 relationship between the two of them. He won't listen to her. She's trying to bring him and Steven together, and she really is being the most rational one under that whole damn mansion.
And yet he calls her irrational.
Mm-hmm. Because why? She's a woman.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
This is just men controlling women's thoughts. You
exactly.
Know, pretty basic stuff.
So she's already low from that. And then you got Alexis, aka the devil in your eyes, coming in and berating her for being barren.
Well, okay, so I think being barren is like, that's sort of the thing all of these issues sort of center on, at least for Crystal, and how we wind up catfighting in the lily pond in the first place. I love this theme that's really well developed in the first act, where there's references to equestrianism and Fallon talking about riding horses and how her little boy is going to grow up to ride a horse. And then they're in the nursery a minute later. Crystal and Steven are sort of talking about this rocking horse. And so there's a sort of like tie-in between children and babies and the equestrian theme. And of course, it's all like sort of saying it without saying it, which is, you know, Crystal aborted her child as a result of horse riding accident, right? So this is all like, and of course, it all is summed up with like Crystal crying empty-armed in the nursery. You know, another one of Crystal's cries, like, which I just love. It just makes me titter with glee.
Well, I get it. And I think Alexis deserved it, not only for her comments and me Crystal miscarry a few years ago, but for also just being so careless to have her back to the lily pond. So when she says all of these jabs at Crystal, all she has to do is call her a miserable bitch and give her a nice shove. Now, she didn't do such a great job because she also went into the pond. I think she could have just been firm-footed and pushed Alexis
in. I mean, if
in,
you really want to play-by-play this, like, did she intend to do that? Did she just not know how to push somebody into a pool without going in with them? You know, so the more interesting thought is that she intended to do that. So she wanted to have a Royal Rumble.
Yeah, I mean, if we do want to do a play-by-play, if this is the WWE, I mean, the ring itself, it's been well noted and documented, because this is one of the most famous scenes from the show, that the lily pond was actually super duper shallow. And seeing it on, you know, 4K DVD on our television.
Yeah, they're like on their knees in there.
You can see they're on their knees. You can see that Alexis's stunt double comes in for a couple of the altercations. I think it's Linda the whole time. And Linda has said in numerous interviews over the years, from Big Valley on, she always liked doing her own stunts and thought it was fun. And she really gives it a go. Although that punch that she lands on Alexis is...
It's pretty classic, like, bad early 80s television production, like, with the cheesy punch sound effect in the background. But you were just saying a minute ago Alexis is stunt double, so do you think Alexis, like, travels with a stunt double, or you meant Joan's stunt double?
No, I mean Joan's stunt double.
That's pretty baller. Like, you know, if you're a billionaireess, I guess she might have a stunt double.
Well, maybe
double.
In later seasons, since they...
Oh.
Since this starts...
you just reminded me there is something later season that involves what you could call an in-show stunt double for a character, but
we won't talk about anything. That one of the things I really loved about the Lily Pond fight is seeing it from different angles, because I think what gets played all the time is them actually lunging in and them hitting each other, but there's that one frame where Blake is driving by, which I didn't even know Blake was part of this. He comes and breaks it all up. But there's this one shot that's like from far away. And
I know. I think it's almost like a Maxfield Parrish painting. Like, it's just elegantly framed by the urns on the gate.
Gorgeously framed.
Grass in the gardens.
And with some distance.
There they are.
You know, it's like a Monet. So the fight actually looks better when they're farther away. And you don't see that they're not actually touching each other, or that it's stunt doubles or whatever. But yeah, I really loved that shot. And that's one that I don't think you see very often. But and then,
well, for me, it's all about two women in glamour gowns sopping wet and ripping jewelry off and, you know, pulling their teased hair. And it's just, you know, it's obviously it's high camp. I mean, that you can't really look at it any other way anymore.
No, the whole episode is so campy. I mean, I really think this is like the crescendo. I think you've been talking about it a lot, that the show's getting campier and campier, but clearly they have leaned into it on all fronts on this episode.
Yeah, I think this is a really good example of in the moment trying to be campy. Like, they knew what they were doing. This is beyond sensationalism. This is like, we're going to have two women in, you know, full dress go in the pool and wrestle. There's no other way to paint that. I mean, it is what it sounds like.
Well, I don't even mean just that. I mean, let's shift and talk a little bit about Steven, because he's got a lot going on in this episode. There's another
Steven like kind of has his whole other separate world going on right now that has nothing to do with all of Alexis's nonsense.
Yeah, well, luckily the writers and directors spare us another Steven and Blake arguing scene. I think they filmed one and they allude to them talking in this episode, but we don't have to sit through it. Instead, we get Steven and then his divorce lawyer Chris, who's back, having brunch at La Mirage.
But isn't this just like the old cliche of like screwing your divorce lawyer?
Well, I don't think they were screwing. I think they were just having a lovely brunch together. You see that brunch? It was immaculate. There was prime rib. There was like a croquembouche. They even did that thing where they put like the lettuce on the bottom of all the plates at the buffet. I mean,
that's such a 70s 80s touch. Like, that's one of those, like, it's out of context now, so it might look fancy to you, but it's just cheesy, really. When you
I'm getting a reservation.
Does anybody eat that piece of lettuce? I mean, come on.
I eat the piece of lettuce and I'll have the celery and the Bloody Marys that they're serving.
This is like how my granny would serve tuna salad in a big ball on top of a piece of lettuce in a bowl. It's the same. I don't know. It's like putting a piece of lettuce under something like makes it that much more. I don't know.
Well, you have to have accessories, right? But anyway, I thought the brunch was, like I said, this whole episode is so campy, even right down to what they're eating. But yes, Chris comes out to Steven.
I left the East and came out to Denver to start fresh. But life in the closet is life in the closet, no matter what the map says. Are you surprised?
I don't know. I don't look for these things.
I didn't really see this coming, but it's kind of nice that there's, you know, two gay men.
Can two grown men go to brunch without later being assigned as gay in the storyline?
No, I think that's definitely one of the rules of homosexuality.
Especially when there's lettuce being served under everything. I feel like that's just, you know, a gay subterfuge.
Yeah, I mean, when you've got a croquembouche over your shoulder like Steven does in that scene, like, clearly this is going to lead to homosexual liaisons.
Is a croquembouche a phallic symbol?
Yeah.
Okay. I just wanted to confirm that.
Back at Steven's new place, he's all moved in. Well, kind of moved in. He still has some boxes. But Chris comes over and presents him with dry sherry. So I guess if you're going to come out to somebody, you give him a nice bottle of dry sherry.
Yeah, what could be more gay than giving somebody a bottle of dry sherry?
Well, I get he was kind of laying the foundation. Like, before he actually said, I'm gay, Steven, he kind of already did say, I'm gay, Steven, with the wrapped bottle of dry sherry. So Steven didn't seem too surprised. So either he's got really good gaydar or the dry sherry just tipped him off.
You know, I like that he mentioned that he would have attached a card, but he didn't. But it would have said,
I'm gay.
Thank you for being a friend.
What? I don't think Golden Girls was on yet.
No, I know. Of course it wasn't. But I think it actually premiered a year and a half after this. But that's all also sort of a retroactively gay reference. So
well,
I
and
like
what
that.
I thought was interesting that they didn't immediately start like making out or talking about how they were going to make love, since I don't think they can say sex
on
this show.
Well, this is what I was about to say a minute ago, because you were like questioning the validity of what I said about them perhaps maybe sleeping together. I don't know. I don't think they really did here, but they keep calling each other friends and, you know, you're going to be my new friend or whatever. And I always felt like, at least back then, that was like sort of, you know, lingo. You know, it's like saying like my roommate, my friend.
My friend of Dorothy.
Right. It's like, we know what you really mean when you say that.
Do you remember when we went on a cruise and they said on the programming there was like
Friends of Dorothy
meeting?
Yeah, meeting at Tuesday at 11:30.
We didn't know what that meant.
I didn't know if that was like Alcoholics Anonymous, if that was like B. Arthur.
Yes,
was
Dorothy's born act.
Yeah.
Dorothy Hamill, was it Ice Skaters?
I don't know. I was kind of intrigued and excited.
But yeah, I guess it's an old school term for gay. I'm just constantly amazed that Steven continues down this gay path, because I thought with the recasting that was going to be wiped from the memory bank.
Well, it's interesting because between the two of them, Chris like says that I left the East to come out West, you know, which interesting usage of come out. But then, of course, he follows that up by saying that he has to still live in the closet. Either way, it's still life in the closet. But then, of course, he says, I admire your courage. But for Steven, though, it's like, is it that courageous? I think Steven's in some sense lucky because he's a, you know, he's got a rich family and he sort of had a charmed upbringing. So maybe for him, it is a lot easier. It's not necessarily courageous. I don't know. I mean, this is a problematic idea, you know, but I have to think that it's easier for Steven to be gay because he's got family money to fall back on and he doesn't have to answer to people.
Yeah, but he doesn't like using his family money. And also, he's bisexual. So, you know, he's not totally gay like his lawyer.
Well, I think we need to quit putting labels on Steven. I, you know, Steven said, yikes, something to the effect of like, he wasn't like looking to sleep around, like when they were having that conversation over sherry. So it was interesting that he was sort of even denying just any sexual activity, period.
Yeah, well, and I think right now he's just focused on living on his own at the El Royale, which is a famous building in LA that constantly is in
Mae West
television.
Had an apartment there.
Yeah. So he's living there. He's got his own house nurse and little Danny is all to himself. So I don't think he's really looking for love right now. But I don't know. We'll see. Maybe him and Chris will have a connection since they're apparently the only two members of the queer community in Denver. But yeah, I mean, other things that were super camp in this episode was at the beginning when Adam and Alexis are having breakfast together. I mean, their meals together are always so fucking fabulous. I wish we ate like that every morning. She then says that she had chocolate croissants flown in
from Paris.
And I'm just thinking, they would be stale by the time they get off the plane, even if they're on like
a
private jet.
Not if they were flown in on a Concorde straight to her landing pad on the roof of her penthouse.
It makes no sense. I mean, if you're going to like boast about your croissants, like, wouldn't you have like a French chef in Denver make them
fresh
for you?
But here's the thing, it's not really...
So they're buttery and...
It's not boasting.
Flaky?
It's not boasting. This is just how Alexis talks. She doesn't even know how ridiculous she is.
But yeah, Adam is not too happy with the whole Neil McVain plot. He sees that it's way too obvious. So he kind of called out, he kind of foreshadowed, I think, that it was going to blow up in her face or get wrapped around her neck, which is exactly what happened. Meanwhile, nobody to this day has figured out that he painted the executive office with poisonous teal paint. So maybe Adam's the smartest one here because his schemes haven't necessarily
come back
to haunt him.
He has a weakness too, as revealed in his little flashback. And, you know, I guess I lied. I said to Richard or Robert Simmons would not be coming back. And
wait, Richard Simmons is going to be in this show?
That would have been interesting. Richard Simmons as the doctor.
Yeah, help me work off that chocolate croissant by sweating to the oldies.
Yeah,
the old timey. This is such a contrived plot where Adam is at La Mirage talking to Fallon, and then
story writing gets tough, just bring back an old character.
Right, the staff member comes in and is like, "Oh, we're having a medical conference," and oh yeah, the old timey doctor that helped Adam through his drug overdose or whatever is coming back. So, you know, this is an instance where
I'd say it's tiresome, but it's actually just everything else is so campy in this episode. This is just adding to it. And so I'm there for it.
Yeah, sure. Why not? Bring on the old timey doctor.
It's been that kind of episode.
And Adam's drug scandal. I mean, I think it's one of those instances where the seed was planted so many episodes ago. So we've got to have the like doodly-doo flashback to remind everybody. And I guess in next week's episode, the season finale, maybe his drug abuse will have something to do with what's happening.
Or maybe it won't. Maybe this is just going to be a dropped thread.
It's entirely possible. Every time I see one of those baby nurses, I think about Christine, that the crazy nurse that was always giving everybody side eye that just went away.
Never to be seen again or spoken of. The characters don't even remember her. But we didn't talk about the best moment. To me, you can have your Lily Pond fight. It's nice and all, but we've seen it. What we didn't talk about is the black cigarette and the egg yolk. That to me is the maybe one of the highest camp moments of the entire production of this show.
Yeah, Joan has really great motor skills because she put that cigarette out right in the middle of the egg yolk.
X marks the spot. Yeah. I don't know what else you can say other than just to admire the moment. And if you're not like shrieking with glee as she does this, like you're watching the show for the wrong reasons.
Yeah. That was when I knew that we were in for a real wild episode.
Right, because this was only like the first part of Act Two. Like we hadn't even gotten to the last stuff. Like,
yeah, I didn't even know the Lily Pond was coming.
I mean, you know, they do this like excellent job with Crystal's infertility, or Crystal being the empty armed Madonna at the beginning in the nursery. And by the way, did you notice that she and Blake were all like severely dressed in pink and blue? So much like nursery dressing and fertility worship like going on with the pinks and blues in the first act.
Well, and Jeff was wearing a purple suit too. There was a lot of couleur in this episode.
No, there was a lot of color, but like they were specifically pink and blue in this first act that was all centered around Crystal losing her baby and Steven having a baby. And then suddenly we go to Kirby and Jeff. Very boring. I don't know what these two are up to. This is the most disinterested.
Well, they're clearly having sex because she's pregnant now.
I guess, but like,
oh, excuse me, making love.
So is that's being suggested by what? Like Jeff is like detailing her shoulder with his wilted lips, you know, or tickling her with like her own hair. The whole thing is just like, it's the most disinterested romance I've ever seen.
It
just keeps going on.
I don't mind them separately, but together they have no chemistry. And I'm wondering, you know, now they do like chemistry reads, like if somebody's auditioning for a film, they'll have people audition together to see if they have chemistry. Did they have that in 1984 or 3 or whatever year we're on?
Yeah, they did. They've been doing that since the beginning of film.
Then how did this happen? Because these two have no chemistry together.
Oh, don't forget you have that appointment this morning with Dr. Winfield.
I feel fine. I feel terrific. I'm going to cancel it.
I'm going to cancel nothing. It's Dr. Winfield.
Or what? My handsome prince will never make love to me again.
Well, that's a thought.
I am so flaccid because every time that they're on the
screen. She's supposed to be the ingenue that has a heart of gold and comes from nothing. And he's supposed to be the yuppie savior. You know, I don't know. I guess were people into that idea back then? Or was this just like they were trying to play to the audience, but really missing the mark. I don't know, but it doesn't play well today. And like, frankly, she's Kirby, and I just keep thinking of the vacuum cleaner. Like, and that's what she is. She's got like all of the presence of, you know, a household industrial item.
Well, she hoovered up Jeff, and now she's already inseminated.
And put her in reverse, and she blows.
And they've only been married for like, what, 2 or 3 episodes? So I don't know what is in Jeff's diet, but he's a very fertile gentleman. But my favorite part of this is...
you're going to say what I was saying. Yeah, go ahead.
When she after she reveals that she's pregnant, she's like, no, I need to get back to shopping.
I mean, what could be more 80s than having an ailment and like, I must go shopping because that will solve my problems.
Right. Oh, I just found out I got pregnant. Now let me go to Rodeo Drive. Or whatever the Denver equivalent is of Rodeo Drive.
Go to Jensen's and pick out a pendant for my cleavage.
Anyway, so I guess we're getting another baby. The only interesting thing is that leads to what you were talking about, Kirby bringing up her mom to Joseph and then Joseph being very secretive about it. So now we've got some other little mystery going on, and Alexis knows and lords that over him. And like you said at the beginning, it's really the only thing where she doesn't get her comeuppance in this episode.
Well, I think that's sort of the magic of Alexis, is she usually has power, and sometimes it's exercised for more than just draining the pond. For everyone she gets, she misses 2 or 3. And so you can never really consider her like, you know, the all-powerful, you know, character in this, you know, in the show. And yet I still love her more than anybody else, other than maybe Claudia. I mean, but we don't have to talk about Claudia because she's not in this episode. But on the other hand, you have Crystal, who all she does is weep in the nursery, weep at La Mirage. I mean... You can talk about Crystal having thoughts and trying to take actions, but again, she wants to, but then she's not very good at it. And she never seems to be able to execute a plan. The most executive thing she's ever done is another one of her fake walkouts. Oh, I'm going to leave again. Like, what is this, the third time? I don't know how many times she's left. But this time, she's leaving to go to La Mirage, which, as we all know, is my favorite purgatorial setting for, you know, people to get sidelined in this show for a few episodes, if not the rest of their characterhood.
The other thing I liked about Kirby is that when she was coming down after her and Jeff were threatening to withhold sex from each other, she saw Fallon and Jeff and their baby having little Blake having like a little kissy kiss moment. And there was like a gong. Did you hear the gong when Kirby was like super shocked? It was like when RuPaul's Drag Race where they have like the shade rattle,
yeah,
you know,
right,
but
yeah.
Now, so I'm hoping this carries on in other Dynasty episodes where when somebody sees something like shocking that jars them, there's like a gong noise.
Well, they definitely were in this season specifically dialing up the expenditure on music production.
Yeah, I mean,
they rewrote a lot of the themes. They took like Alexis's, you know, doom theme that's always like when they show her penthouse from the exterior.
Mm-hmm.
They rewrote a whole sort of re-envisioning of that theme for this specific episode. I had never heard that version before.
Yeah.
And to your point, like that kind of stuff, like, so they were really dialing up the production. I mean, they were just going for sweeping drama anywhere they could get.
And that's what gives it that soapy, cheesy, campy feeling too, is the music. And it even seems like the scenes are going a little faster too. Like in this episode, watching it, I was like, wow, is this like a 2 hour long episode? Is this a very special episode? Because there were so many scenes.
Yeah.
But I think that's partly because this is the penultimate episode of season 3. So we're sort of wrapping up a lot of these storylines, or things that have been planted are concluding. So it really feels like we're going into like a really exciting moment with the third season. And I think they've got something very special planned, having never watched it before.
I think it's pretty satisfying from end to beginning. You've had this through line the whole episode of Neil McVane running around on an all-day bender, you know, because he's been ousted from Congress. And I even like how in the beginning, Blake's like, you know, he's in Blake's office and Blake asks him to have some coffee. Instead of going for the coffee station, he goes over to the bar and pours some scotch. Here we are later that evening.
Well, I also liked how Marsha, the worst secretary in the history of secretaries smells his breath and kind of gives Blake a dirty look like, oh, God, this guy's sauce.
Marcia is so full of hot takes and eye rolls. I love Marcia.
Yeah, she kind of won me over. I thought she was really terrible before. But
sidebar, you remember toward the end where Blake and Crystal are having that annoying conversation at La Mirage, and Blake's talking about how he knew Crystal was going to be the one when she walked in as his new secretary that day. And I'm thinking, well, what if Crystal wasn't there? And what if Marcia was the one that came in? And like, what if this whole show were Marcia and Blake?
Marcia. No. Marcia, I think, is too old for Blake.
Well, I mean, Marcia is just a spit-polished school marm, but I think that would have been much more interesting than Crystal and all of her inactivity. And
if only instead of the Colbys, they would have had a spinoff called Marcia, and you could have learned more about her and her life.
Well, I guess there's a fan fiction for anything. So,
well, I'll be writing fanfic about Alexis's new secretary, Bernard. Hubba hubba.
You know, I wanted to like hubba hubba, but he's, you know, he's classically decent looking, and I can see why she hired him for the stable.
Yeah,
but I love that she says your first week was good. You know, like, well, what does that mean? I mean, what is Alexis and Bernard really been up to for a week?
It means she's moved on from Mark Jennings and whatever that first male secretary's name was.
Oh, she doesn't even refer to him as Mark anymore. He's just a tennis bum in her eyes.
The tennis bum. But yeah, no, Bernard, I thought maybe he was like a football player or something, but I guess he was just an actor who was in a lot of stuff like Star Trek and some that movie Hunk that we watched.
That's why you made me watch that stupid movie.
No, I made you watch it because I thought it would be like Mannequin.
Nothing could be like Mannequin. What are you talking about?
Anyway, I'm excited for the season finale. I think Neil McVane is not done yet because he's out for blood. And I'm interested to see if Steven and Chris share more than a bottle of dry sherry.
Well, the only final thing I would say about Neil McVane, other than his all-day bender, is his great-looking gray. What is this weird blue hair dye? And like, he even like moves his brow in a weird way that suggests perhaps he's wearing a toupee. They did not do this poor actor justice because he looks ridiculous. But maybe that's what they were going for because of the whole all day drinking thing. I don't know.
Well, they also didn't do him justice because why do we care about him? He's not really involved in anybody's life except for being this MacGuffin to make things happen.
Yeah,
in DC.
He really is a character that is thrust upon us. And like, I'm with you. I don't really care. I was really hoping he was gone after whatever last storyline he was involved with. It's kind of the same way as the Mark Jennings character. Like, Mark Jennings kind of just functions as a thing, not as a person.
But Jeffrey Scott is so damn charismatic that it doesn't matter. And plus, we do have a backstory with him and Crystal. So there's more to
latch on to. But that's what I'm saying about, like, okay, yeah, you're right. He's a little more dimensional than I suppose Neil McVane is. But again, he is. He just serves as a function for Crystal's illegitimate marriage to Blake and this thing between Fallon and Alexis.
Honey, so, I think the function that he serves is to service all of the women on this show, because he's been with all of them, except for Kirby, I think. But who knows? Maybe next season.
Well, you know, I have a strict no-tie policy at the tennis courts.
Now it's time for the part of the episode where we talk about our looks of the week. Kyler, what looks were you feeling?
Well, okay, you could go two directions on this. I'm going to go with the first direction, which is I love, love, love Joan in the dark green, you know, I don't know if that's ultra suede or if it's like actual suede dress that sort of shows up at the end of Act 3 and through the remaining, you know, part of the show.
The one where she strangled?
Yes, the one in which she's strangled, but she also shows up in the kitchen to, you know, sort of strong arm Joseph about, you know, draining the lily pond. So what I really love
green
is,
it looks like purple or blue. Everything looks
are
purple
you colorblind?
And blue to
no,
me this
that
episode.
That is dark forest green if I ever saw it smacked across my face. So the best part is it's accessorized with a matching sort of like cleavage cozy. I don't know if that's like a glamour bib or what that is.
I know. I was like, honey, haven't you heard? We don't have to wear the face masks anymore. Take it off.
Well, you know, and she sort of like, first she refers to it as like, well, I'm trying to prevent a cold as she clutches it. So it's like, oh, by warming your your neck area and your cleavage, you're not going to get a cold.
Maybe but she then, dipped it in, what's that stuff called? Mott's apple juice.
Vicks Vipo Rub. Yeah,
maybe she dipped it in Vicks. Vicks Vipo Rub.
Vicks Vapo Rub. Yeah, possibly. I don't think so. And then, but then I love that at the end when Neil is strangling her, it may be that mystical cloth that protects her from truly being strangled.
Oh, so you think there's some medicinal value.
Yeah, I kind of love how her sort of like deceptive, I don't know, contrived fashion in some sense maybe saves the day. And Alexis gets to, you know, go on to, you know, more dastardly deeds in future episodes. So the other direction you could take, I suppose, like, again, I already mentioned it, like women in glamour gowns, like wet in the pool. And, you know, and I love Alexis, like one shoe on and one shoe off. And, you know, she flings her spectator pump into the bushes as she storms off from Blake. And so, you know, there's something there, but it's not so much the clothes per se. It's more the context and the, you know, the humidity and the dampness of it all.
Well, if it's a battle between these two women, Crystal and Alexis, not physically, but fashion, I have to give it to Crystal, because here Alexis is just wearing another black and white. We've seen her wear this a gazillion times. I mean, it looks great. That swirly pattern is fun, but I'm sorry.
It's an abstract rose print.
Oh, okay. Every rose has its thorn, and the thorn in this case is Crystal. And
oh, shut up, Rose.
Blue, slinky satin, silky number with the slit
it's
up
rayon.
The side. I didn't want to say the R word. Yeah, she's got that slit up the side with her leg out. And, you know, I think that sexy leg is really what drove Crystal to go walk out to the lily pond and confront her. Because she's like, oh, thinks she's going to be the one showing some skin here. It's an iconic look for an iconic scene. Unfortunately, she didn't accessorize it with a hat or a bag, so she didn't have any things to beat Alexis.
It's very under accessorized. but I think there's a tie in this scene specifically with looks, because there's nothing like women with ruined hair and makeup looks.
Yeah, well, and rayon looks much better dry than it does wet. Do not machine wash or lily pond wash.
Yeah, that's printed on my vagina.
Well, that's it for this installment of Dynasty As They Want to Be. Kyler, thank you so much for joining me.
Good night, you all.
Y'all. If y'all want to follow along on our journey, please give us a like on social media and subscribe and follow. We're on Instagram, Twitter, all the places at Nasty Podcast. That's N-A-S-T-Y Podcast. Join us next time where we discuss the third season finale, The Cabin.
I am the Earth Mother, and you are all flops.